Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson. Hey, Fred, I was thinking this morning about...
hope you didn't hurt yourself there.
It went pretty well.
Oh, okay. That's good.
And about topics, you know, because we do these podcasts and we've been influencing our book to align more with the thread of influencing decisions. Mm-hmm. And so I was working on that a little bit in relation to our book. And I was just happy to think about some of the decisions that I've influenced over the years as a manager of reliability or whatever positions I've had. Mm-hmm. And some of the stories were starting to come to mind. And I thought that'd be an interesting topic for you and I, which is just to share some of the more, could I use the word influential, decisions that we've influenced, ones that come to mind, things that were interesting to us, and just to heighten the awareness of how we go about influencing decisions as part of our job as reliability engineers.
Oh, yeah.
So there's just a topic. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, geez. We're going to try to keep it to 20 minutes, right?
Yes.
We might have to come back and do this one again. There's so many times that, and I have to credit my former boss at HP, who was basically always on us to make sure we track down, well, how useful was your work, right? What difference did it make? Show the value kind of thing. And we got in the habit of following up with, after we worked with one of the product divisions or with a team or something like that, is to then, what, in their words, what difference did it make? And so it, because a lot of times, you know, especially in consulting, we'll go in and we'll teach something, we'll work on a project, we'll do an FMEA with a team, and then it's, all right, you guys go work on it. And it's rare that you come back and circle back with them and say, all right, how much of a difference did it make? And I find out more often is when it really worked well is they usually come back and want me to come work with them again, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I do remember, even in you know, working directly with product teams, and I've told this story before, is that we made an effort to get a high-speed camera for the lab because we had an electromechanical, it was a printer, right? We had moving parts and we wanted to see how they moved. And I wish I would have had like this motion amplification cameras that are available now, because then we could really go after these mechanical guys. No, that real thin film that you're putting there is not structural. It moves all the time. Goes, no, it doesn't look. It doesn't move. And we could prove them otherwise. But anyway, it was one of those cases where they wanted to put a circuit board in and they had limited space and they wanted to use an edge connector and stand it straight up. And it would be perpendicular to the printhead, which had a bunch of ink cartridges in it. So it was a big mass moving back and forth. And there's circuit board that was standing on end at one side of it. And it's like 6-8 inches tall. And we thought, that's not a good idea. Circuit boards will flex when they have that much mass moving in the body of this thing. It's going to show up there. And he's like, no, it won't do it. No. And we don't have a way to do it. It'd be too hard, blah, 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 blah. It was impossible to connect it. All right. So we went down to the lab, turned on the high-speed camera. Within 30 seconds, the machine stopped. And we're like, what's going on? So we replayed the tape. And right in the middle, just as it stopped, you could see the board flexing. And this one of the capacitors or some component came off, and you could see it do its little flip, you know, cartwheels off into the air, and then it all stopped. And so this is one of those where the influence in the decision was, we said, Bill, you need to see this. And I hit video. I didn't say a word. It stopped. He could see the motion of it. And he said, okay. And the next day, the circuit board was realigned and reattached and bolted down so it wouldn't flex at all.
That's interesting. So did you know, was there a decision that you were aware of before the problem with the flex of the circuit board became evident? In other words, in that story, it's a great story. Is it just something where, yes, we have to make a decision and we're doing this, that you were aware of, or was it something that you influenced the decision after it became a problem?
Well, I was aware of it, that they were mounting the circuit board this way. And the review, when they had the concept design, and we didn't even have prototypes yet, and they were saying, we're going to mount this on an edge connector straight up here. And I says, you know, well, why is that not attached? You know, circuit right. boards really do not like being free and able to move. And the decision was that it would be, the tolerance stack up would be too difficult to go from the base plate of this machine through 15 other pieces of the product to other attachment points. It would be too costly and too expensive. And so that was the decision. That was here's the space we have. It's constrained, you know, and that's what we're going to do. That's our plan of attack. And then the decision was defended is that, well, you're a reliability engineer. You don't know mechanical engineering well enough to understand the complexity here. Okay. So the decision became very easy when sample one failed in 30 seconds. You know,
well, you've just highlighted one of the because we use the words influencing decisions, and because reliability engineers aren't always the decision makers, and so the decision makers are often the project engineers or the design release engineers, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so you have to influence the decision. Sometimes you can do that before the consequence. Other times the consequence happens and then you influence the decision. So it's fascinating.
Well, what happened out of that is that the credibility of, I guess these guys know what they're talking about. And so our ability to influence prior to a failure occurring increased dramatically. You know, but we still had to do the homework. We still had to have our act together. But it's part of that building the credibility is a part of it. And in that particular case, we just had a spectacular way to do it by chance. And we were very, I think the team would have found it as we made, you know, another 20 or 30 circuit, you know, systems and fired them up. They would have all failed for one part or another, cracking or even mm-hmm. traces cracking. So I think it would have been discovered. But I think the influence part was, and we really did have to bite our tongues and go, now, you know, we told you so.
You didn't want to say I told you so.
Yeah, you really don't want to do that.
You really want to. I know.
I know.
Well, that's interesting because the influence part then, because we can be old school. And believe me, I started out old school, which is you wait for the problem to happen and then you roll up your sleeves and start fixing it. Mm-hmm. And the influence part comes in when you're trying to prevent. And that's interesting. That's not the only influence. I have a story that relates to the Cadillac CTS. Mm-hmm. That was a program that I got involved in early on when I was a GM. By early on, I mean it was in the concept stage and we knew we had a lot of decisions hadn't been made. And I'd been wanting a program to try out something, which is supplier reliability. I've told this story a few times where at GM and a lot of other companies, there is a subject of supplier quality that's very mature, mm-hmm. but supplier reliability is not. And it becomes something where nobody seems to have responsibility for the reliability requirements and assuring that they're met.
You know, and probably that quality manager that you're dealing with, and I've run into them, is they think, well, reliability is just a part of quality. If we make it well, if we make a high quality yeah. part, it'll be reliable. And we're like, yeah. No. It won't.
they're concerned about dimensions. They're concerned about first time performance.
Yields, stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. But the subject of does it last 10 to 15 years, Does it last through all of the customer usage and environment? That subject for supplier parts is not as mature.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted a program to try out influencing decisions, and there wasn't anybody that had the job of supplier reliability. So I thought, well, here's an interesting thought. What if we influence the purchasing decision, and instead of buying parts based on low cost or timing, we also considered whether the supplier had the reliability capability. So I started working with the VP of purchasing, and I sat in on a number of the supplier interviews,
mm-hmm.
where they're deciding whether or not to select a supplier. And some people would be talking about the marketing and the packaging and the cost, and I'd be there asking them about their processes and their design reliability techniques, things like that.
Right.
And so I became part of the decision,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
as to whether to pick certain suppliers. That was a fairly rewarding influence.
And that illustrates the point to me is that, and it's not black and white, it's either reliable or not. We always are faced with uncertainty, and processes and techniques and even where they manufacture something changes over time. Parts go obsolete. There's an ongoing discussion about keeping something reliable. But during the purchase decision, it's your contribution illustrates it's in balance with all these other factors. And that's where I can see these, you know, and I've used it as if this is their process capability, given our specifications, we're going to get ahead in yield, and the yield loss is going to cost us this much, right? And then let's extrapolate that out to that, say 5% of those products we don't catch, they're on the margin and they don't get caught in our screening and in production line, and they get to the field, and then I'll cite that I'm sure you're familiar with it, is the engine block that was built. It was designed and built in Japan and in the U.S. And the ones in Japan just way outlasted the other ones. And it was a difference between it's in spec or it's centered and tight. And I'd use that story and I'd say, you know, let's just assume a small number of these are on the margin and they fail quicker. And that will cost us this much money. But it illustrates just another piece of information, a way of thinking about weighing the benefits of the price break or the shipping times or the marketing or the packaging or whatever. Because all of those other things matter. But when you don't include the consequences or the costs or the considerations of reliability and its impact, then it's not part of that decision. So just by being at the meeting and asking those questions, you're influencing all those other people of, well, okay, this is important. We're talking about it. And if they sit back and look at it and go, we have like a 1% problem here, that's going to wipe out the entire profit for this particular line.
Well, it's a good vision. It's a good narrative that you're sitting at the table. You're not always sitting at a table.
No.
You might be in a web meeting. You might be, you know, but the concept that you're a team player along with other team players, it's like a systems engineering approach.
Yep.
Where you're one of the considerations.
And, you know, and it always is that. It's a compromise. I mean, a quick story is we had a chip that was ESD sensitive, and it was very sensitive, actually. I'm sorry, EMI. It was radiating, and we could measure it in our initial setups we had that it was radiating way too much. And the common technique at that time was to put a shield over it, to ground it, put a Faraday cage around it. And the mechanical engineer was just, there's not room, we're attaching to a circuit board, we're doing this, we're doing that, the other thing. And it's like, all right, let's get together, the compliance guy, us and the reliability team, the mechanical engineer and the electrical engineer. Because it was one of those devices that a mechanical engineer had to design and build and install, essentially, on the board. But it was an electrical component. And so the electrical engineer said, well, I need space to do traces. I can't just attach this blindly on here. And how are we going to ground it? And the compliance guys are like, well, you know, here's the data that shows that it's here and here, and where's the problem? And we could go, you know, a much more expensive shield that's on the entire circuit board. We could do this for that. And it, my role really wasn't related to here's the failure rate of this thing or what anything else. It was really just a facilitation. Let's get these three different silos together. And what are the possibilities of solving this thing? And out of that meeting came, you know, here's a couple of experiments we're going to do that'll give us a direction to go. But sometimes our influence is just helping because of where we sit. When you mentioned systems engineering, is where we sit, we cross silos so often. And so we can pull the right people together and say, all right, here's a problem. Let's solve this thing. And that's our influence venue capability.
Yeah, that's very good. And I've often thought co-location is an important concept. Mm-hmm. And like when I had a team of reliability engineers, half of them were associated with projects like Corvette, Malibu. Mm-hmm. And so I would co-locate them. I'd have them sit on those project teams. And the other half were associated with functional areas. So I co-locate them with the functional teams. Mm-hmm. And it really helps because you're sitting at a coffee break or you're just walking, you're standing at your desk, and it's much easier to get in conversation and influence the designs when you're sitting there right with them.
Well, I don't know. I worked with an electrical engineer early on in my career, and his shoulders would slump and just sigh whenever I darkened his door. Yeah, and he's like, hey, what's the matter, Ed? What's the problem? And he goes, every time you show up, you're bringing me a problem. It's like, it's a good point. Let me try to help you solve some of these.
Great, great lesson learned.
Yeah.
Okay, no. So I've got here's another story that comes to mind is on the Corvette program. I had a good relationship with the chief engineer as manager of reliability. And he invited me to come in to the weekly big meeting where they have all the teams together, mm-hmm. Where they go over status. And he said, you have 5 minutes. And this is like a 2-hour meeting where they're going over status of everything, and he gives reliability 5 minutes. So I had 5 minutes to influence the reliability. Now, that's not the only time. Obviously, we're doing FMEAs, we're doing tasks. But in terms of communicating with the management, I had 5 minutes. And so the question was, what measurements did I show to reflect reliability progress? Mm-hmm. And in 5 minutes, you only have the ability to show a couple charts.
Yep.
And so I had to narrow down the long list of possibilities into a few charts that we would track that would represent the reliability. And so it was my own personal decision as to which ones to show, but then it was influencing the decision as to whether the reliability was progressing satisfactorily, mm-hmm. in order to move from a gate to a gate.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember, I had that's where I started moving towards reliability plan, because what I decided to do was to say, here's the tasks that we have laid out. And this week we accomplished this task, and therefore we have this many to go. I have basically made it task-based rather than just trying to show some reliability prediction metric, which was fluffy.
Yeah, we don't want to go there.
Yes. So that's another sharing of a story.
Related to that, and it wasn't my influence. I heard about this story, but it was a technical marketing manager. It was his role on this, I think it was a workstation platform they were working on, and they were losing market share. They were struggling. And a main driver of it, their customers would tell them is look, we need this machine to work. And when it fails, it takes us a week to get it repaired, and it fails too often, and it's bad for our business. We have to go with Dell or IBM or somebody else that's more reliable. And so they were just getting hammered. And it's not a huge market at that time. And so the program manager emphasized the reliability part, but they didn't have a reliability engineer. There were very few reliability engineers in the corporation. And they you know, said, well, we need to double down and make sure we do a good job kind of thing. And so the technical marketing manager had heard about a reliability block diagram. So he opened up one of the books laying around and said, oh, okay, well, we have a series system. We have a motherboard, a CPU, power supply, keyboard, blah, blah, blah. And he just kind of listed them all down. And he knew that the reliability goal had to be as good or better than the competition. And so he had some rough estimates for what that could be, or what, and they had field data from their previous ones, so he knew that wasn't good enough. So he said, well, we got to be, and I'm making up numbers, 95% reliable over 5 years. And then he said, well, that's not useful to the power supply team. So he read about apportionment, and he goes, well, I have no idea what these numbers are. So he just did a straight line. Everybody gets 99%. And the five items then tallied up to 95% at the system level. So that's all he did.
Oh.
Right. And he took that to the staff meeting, and it was, you know, they had electrical, mechanical, the supply, you know, the different silos for the suppliers and stuff like that were all there. And he presented that and said, you know, keyboard, your goal is 99%, you know, power supply, your goal is 99%. So the keyboard guy was really happy because that was a piece of cake. As far as he was concerned, he never heard of a failure of their keyboards. The power supply guy was in like, impossible. We're not even, you know. And so the program manager, she looked at the power supply guy and said, all right, next week, come back with three options to improve the reliability and with a better estimate of what you can really achieve. And then so each week, Phil would update this simple spreadsheet and do the math and say, all right, we want 95%, but we're at 82%. And right now the key, you know, the motherboard is the weakest link. And so the program manager would look at that group and say, all right, next week, come back with three proposals to how are you going to bridge this? And it, that very simple model updated weekly. And at first it was just flatline guess, right? And then it got improved by engineering knowledge. Then it got improved by supplier test data. Then it got improved by modeling and other tools over the course of the development project. But by being a consistent small section of the program team's meeting, it allocated resources, it directed energies, you know, instead of everybody trying to squeeze another ounce of reliability out of it, it was the weakest link was where the benefit was. So they put all their effort into that area. And the decisions were influenced as a trade-off between improving failure rate versus how much it's going to cost us to do it. Do we put redundancy in here to achieve this? Do we do that? And it was what Phil told me, it was a 5-minute discussion each week. And that was it. And it took him about a half an hour to poll the team to update the model each week before the meeting.
That's fantastic. And that's very task-based. It's very, it gets away from all the fishy stuff.
Right. And it wasn't something that goes on the wall and everybody could walk by and say, oh, that's cool. Or it's on a monitor somewhere. It was a trigger for a conversation. And it was, there was two pieces that made that really work. One was that Phil just did it and brought it to the meeting. And he had a voice at that meeting that was concerned about this eventual achieving this goal. And then the program manager saying, ah, I understand. If we improve the weakest part, we improve the overall system. And then being consistent by saying, all right, this is the problem this week. You go fix this. You know, what are the options? What's our trade-offs here? And then it wasn't just that task was done. It was that it created a series of conversations and priorities through the development process. And that was phenomenal.
That's great. That's a great story. I bet our listeners have some stories.
I hope so. I know we're not alone in seeing this happen. And if you do, head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you'll find a contact form there and you can get in touch with us. You can find Carl and I on LinkedIn or on our about pages. There's ways to get in touch with us there. But every now and then, you know, Carl, we all often talk about failures and problems and dilemmas and stuff like that. But it's a lot of work we do, if we pay attention to the comments we make and the discussions we do and the guidelines we publish and the recommendations we make, it has a tremendous impact on the profitability of your organization and the customer satisfaction. And sometimes it just takes paying attention to that's happening. And So that was fun. I could go another 2 hours here, Carl.
I know. All right, great conversation.
All right, thanks, Carl.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.